Greetings, friends. This is a Dhamma talk on the Sabbasava Sutta, the Sutta on the Seven Ways of Ending Mental Fermentations. This talk is recorded at our Tuesday evening Dhamma class in Frenchtown, New Jersey on September 20th, 2016. Included in this talk is our Sangha Q&A and discussion. I have edited out our 20-minute meditation session. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. So again, good evening, everyone. If there's any questions while I'm reading the article for tonight, please just put up your hand or holler at me, and let's keep our comments and discussions for after we meditate, so we can get through all this. It's a little bit of a long sutta or article. The Sabbasava Sutta. In the Sabbasava Sutta, the Buddha teaches the ending of mental fermentations through appropriate or refined mindfulness. Another word often used in the Pali Canon for fermentations is defilements, or fetters is another word. In the Vatthuma Sutta, the Buddha describes defilements, it's a rather long list, as greed, ill will, anger, hostility, denigration, domineering, envy, jealousy, hypocrisy, fraud, obstinacy, presumption, conceit, arrogance, vanity, and negligence. It's good that none of us have any of those qualities. These are also known as fetters and are sometimes listed simply as greed, aversion, and deluded or conditioned thinking, which does include all those defiling mental qualities. And that's from the Majjhima Nikaya 95. The Sabbasava Sutta. The Buddha was at Savatthi in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery, where he presented this teaching. Friends, the ending of the fermentations is for one who knows and understands skillful and unskillful mindfulness. In other words, what we hold in mind. The ending of the fermentations is not possible by one who does know or understand skillful and unskillful mindfulness. When one is inappropriately mindful, fermentations arise and increase. When one is skillful in their application of mindfulness, additional fermentations do not arise, and present fermentations are abandoned. So remember, the Buddha taught mindfulness in two very specific applications. One was the four foundations of mindfulness, and then the other was to be mindful of each factor of the Eightfold Path. And so that's the refined mindfulness that he's referring to here. Friends, there are seven ways to abandon fermentations, and these are direct applications of mindfulness. There are fermentations that are to be abandoned by understanding. In one lacking instruction of the Eightfold Path, having no regard for the Dhamma or for those of integrity, those who have integrated the Dhamma, this one cannot discern what is skillful to be mindful of and what is unskillful to hold in mind. They are lacking the framework for clear knowing provided by the Eightfold Path. And what are the ideas that are unskillful to be mindful of? Whatever ideas that when held in mind develop sensual craving or increase sensual craving. So there's no ambiguity there either. What should we hold in mind? What should we avoid? The Eightfold Path guides the way. Through unskillful sensual craving, establishment of self-craving develops, continues, and increases. When sensual craving increases, ignorance does as well. It ties that right to the initiating understanding that he awakened to, that initial ignorance that through 12 causative links causes all the suffering in our world. I'm going to read it again. Through unskillful sensual craving, establishment of self-craving develops, continues, and increases. When sensual craving increases, ignorance does as well. These are ideas that are to be mindfully recognized and mindfully abandoned. A simple process. Recognize what's unskillful and let it go. There's no process, there's no analysis, there's no rites or rituals, there's nothing to do except recognize it in your own mind and let it go. And what are ideas to be appropriately mindful of? Any ideas that do not develop sensual craving or increase sensual craving. Appropriate or right mindfulness releases any sensual craving that has developed, and no establishment of craving for a self arises, and the fermentation of ignorance is abandoned. By simply developing that mindfulness framed by the Eightfold Path. These are ideas that are unskillful to hold in mind. And these are the great questions of mankind. If you remember, I talk about Vajragoda often. These are the questions that Vajragoda would come. He'd ask the Buddha about them. The Buddha would say, you know, it's your questions that are confusing you. Sometimes he'd say, you foolish man. It's your questions that are confusing you. And Vajragota would mumble and he'd walk away and he'd come back a year or two or 5 years later with the same questions. These are the ideas that are unskillful to hold in mind. Did I exist in the past? Did I not exist in the past? Will I exist in the future? Will I not exist in the future? What am I now? What am I not? That means, do I exist or do I not exist? Where have I come from? Holding in mind these unskillful ideas, six confused and deluded views will arise. The view that I have a self is established. The view that I have no self is established, which relates to the development of the idea of nothingness or emptiness, which is a wrong application of that, or annihilation. I have a self because I perceive a self. That's much like that saying, I think, therefore I am. It's, and to talk about a self-referential view, just because I think this is who I am, it must be who I am. Remember the, a couple weeks ago we talked about the Kula Sakaka Sutta and those questions that Sakaka had? They're very similar to this. And the end result of that is the Buddha showed Sakaka where he was just continuing with eye-making by insisting on these certain things. I have a self because I perceive that I am not a self. That's confused and discursive thinking. It just keeps you locked up in that thicket of views. I am not a self because I perceive a self, another confused and discursive way of thinking. I am constant, everlasting, eternal, and never-changing. That's the idea, the underlying idea that was common to the Buddha's time and common today, that inherent in me is an everlasting soul that continues throughout eternity. And whether or not that's true is not important. The Buddha never said that that's not true or that any of these things are not true. He never said they are true. He simply said that that continued consideration of them is a distraction from what's occurring. It's taking you out of the Dhamma, it's taking you out of what's occurring in the present moment, and it will only continue to confuse you and delude your thinking. It's a self-referential ego personality that wants to pin those questions down. Who am I? Where do I come from? Where am I going? Instead of recognizing through developing of the Eightfold Path that what we are is in a continual state of becoming. And that points to the potential of each moment. Each moment holds the potential to incline our minds towards awakening, or to continue confusion, delusion, and ongoing suffering. The Buddha continues. This is a thicket of views that binds one to endless confusion, delusion, and suffering that binds one to endless dukkha. One who is well instructed in the Dhamma, who has developed the Eightfold Path, and who has high regard for the Dhamma and those with integrity in regards to the Dhamma, discerns what ideas are skillful to be mindful of and are to be cultivated, and what ideas are unskillful to be mindful of and to be abandoned. This one remains mindful of skillful qualities and remains free of unskillful qualities. Having developed a refined mindfulness framed by the Eightfold Path, they remain mindful of. This is stress. This is the origination of stress. This is the cessation of stress. The Eightfold Path is a path developing the cessation of stress. So the Buddha brings that whole conversation back to the Four Noble Truths. He brings everything back to the context of what he taught for 45 years. With this refined mindfulness, the fermentations of identity view, self-referential or eye-making views, confusion and grasping after and clinging to unskillful precepts and rituals. These are fermentations that are directly abandoned by right understanding the right view. Number two, there's seven of these. There are fermentations that are to be abandoned by, so the first fermentation is to be abandoned by simply developing understanding. So in a way, the Buddha's coming at the problem of confused and deluded thinking in seven different ways here, but they all end up at the same point, right view. Number two, there are fermentations that are to be abandoned by restraint. With the refined mindfulness developed through the framework of the Eightfold Path, this one remains restrained and not distracted by contact with the eyes or the nose or the tongue or the ear or the body or the intellect. The fermentations that would arise in those unrestrained at the six senses do not arise in one who has developed restraint. Again, it's kind of a long-winded way of saying that we learn to practice restraint at our senses. Sometimes it's called the sense gate. We recognize as things are coming through our senses, whatever they might be, in a very profound way, that this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. It's simply what's occurring in my ongoing becoming. That's all. We don't personalize any of these things. We don't create another identity over it. Number three, there are fermentations that are to be abandoned by proper use of what is necessary without creating an identity view from using. This is fascinating to me because of the simple practicality of it, because I'll read on, but we all create identities over these things that we just should be dispersonally using as a part of having a human life. There's things that we need to engage with, but we don't need to create an identity over it. So this one, meaning an awakened one, this one uses a robe solely for protection and modesty, not for having the best clothes around. I remember when I got into high school, I was a member of just about every popular clique at the time. I was attracted to one, I joined the clique, and that lasted for a little while, and something else caught my attention. So in other words, I think I started out as a hippie, and so I had long hair and those clothes, and that was my identity. I put on the robes of being a hippie, and then I started playing football, and I became a jock, and I started wearing those types of clothes. And for a very, very brief time, about a minute, I was an academic. So I was wearing a lot of polo shirts. But I kept acquiring. I mean, I look back on that. And every time there was a person that I wanted to be, the only thing I really did to become that person was to put on the robes of that person. And that qualified me. This is what a Dhamma teacher wears, by the way. Well, you wouldn't expect a Dhamma teacher to be wearing jeans or shorts.
Sounds like you're trying to be preppy.
Well, next week I'll be wearing robes, real robes. And a big, tall hat, too. You know, I always like those hats that the Greek Orthodox wear. I really love that. Some of the Tibetan Buddhists. All right, let me get back to it. This one uses a robe solely for protection and modesty. This one uses food not for entertainment or for intoxication, remember that other line, or for growing large, or for beautification, but simply for the survival. I think it must have been some enamoration with very big people during the Buddha's time, because that line comes up a lot, or for growing large, or for beautification, but simply for the survival and continuation of the body so that the Eightfold Path can be fully developed. This one uses lodging solely for protection and the enjoyment of seclusion. This one uses medicine for the purpose of curing sickness and to be free of pain and disease. The fermentations of unskillful using, creating an identity from what is used, are abandoned by skillful using. Simply not creating identity of those things that we have to engage with. Number four, there are fermentations that are to be abandoned by tolerating. One who tolerates, who abandons reaction to worldly causes and conditions, such as cold or heat or wind or harsh words or unpleasant sensations or nagging insects, will not give rise to fermentations and remain free of fermentations by simply, I'm adding the word simply, by tolerating what is occurring. And isn't that kind of the secret? That's what we end up with. We simply are at peace with the people and events of our lives as they occur, including ourselves. That's a fully mature, awakened human being. You're no longer reacting. Your mind remains at peace and at calm, tolerating. Simple directions. Number five, there are fermentations that are to be abandoned by avoiding. One who mindfully avoids sitting in unsuitable seats prone to distraction or eye-making. This one avoids sitting with wild or harmful animals or sitting in brambles or in a cesspool. Could occur. It still could happen today.
That sounds pretty skillful.
Well, you know, when I first came across this, I had that reaction, and it's an appropriate reaction. But I think what the Buddha is talking about in that case, and probably in all these cases, is creating an extreme environment to create almost another ascetic practice. I'm going to sit in this pile of crap because I'm not going to let it bother me. I'm going to sit in a situation where I know it's prone to wild animals attacking human beings because they won't bother me. It's inappropriate. It's all part of eye-making. That's what the Buddha's teaching here. Or or in a cesspool or other unsuitable habitats. This one avoids association with unskillful friends. This one avoids fermentations by avoiding what is skillful to avoid. In other words, make rational, mindful decisions that support your practice and don't take it to extremes just to prove that you can do it. There's other modern practices that are very akin to the asceticism that the Buddha turned his back on, and I won't get into that today, but it'll probably be next week's talk. Number six, there are fermentations that are to be abandoned by destroying arisen thoughts of ill will or cruelty, meaning we have to be mindful of them and destroy them. Now the word destroy is a translation of the Pali word that I can't remember, but it's using the word destroy infers the determinations that's necessary to end these types of fermentations. These fermentations that are to be abandoned by destroying arisen thoughts of ill will or cruelty. This one abandons hurtful thoughts, words, and deeds and eliminates them from their existence. Number seven, there are fermentations that are to be abandoned by developing the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. With the refined mindfulness developed through the Eightfold Path, they remain mindful of awakening, dependent on seclusion, on dispassion, on cessation, on release from clinging. They develop an understanding of the qualities of persistence, inspiration, serenity, concentration, and equanimity as factors of awakening. Having developed this understanding through the Eightfold Path, the fermentations are abandoned. All very practical advice, isn't it? It all relates back to remaining mindful of the framework of the Eightfold Path. The Buddha continues, when a Dhamma practitioner has abandoned the fermentations through understanding, restraint, proper using, tolerating, avoiding, destroying, and developing, this one has severed all craving and clinging and has ended all fetters through right understanding of conceit, of eye-making. This one has ended all confusion, delusion, and unsatisfactory experiences. That's the end of the sutta. The Sabbasabba Sutta shows clearly the proper use of refined mindfulness. The Eightfold Path provides the guidance and effective framework for recognizing and abandoning mental fabrications that can only lead to ongoing confusion, delusion, and unsatisfactory experiences. As concentration increases and supports the refined mindfulness to hold in mind these seven qualities, it becomes possible to recognize and abandon what is unskillful to hold in mind and to develop what is most skillful to be mindful of. So that's the end of the article. I don't know if you've noticed this, the last 3 or 4 weeks, all the suttas are directly related to how to practically apply the Eightfold Path. The Vitakasanthana Sutta that we talked about last week is the same way. How to apply the Dhamma. The Buddha never presented his teachings in any conceptual way. In other words, he didn't create ideas that we're supposed to develop or inhabit. He taught a very direct and purposeful, he taught very direct and purposeful actions that we can take to develop our own awakening. And why did he do that? Why didn't he just teach concepts such as love or compassion or emptiness or anything else like that? Because concepts can't be directly applied. We can't really develop concepts, can we? But we can, as human beings, we can take directions from someone who knows and hopefully follow through with them and have the same experience. That's the entirety of the Buddha's Dhamma, is following his direction. That's what he awakened to. When he awakened, you heard me say this many times, he sat for 2 more weeks considering how could he teach this? Because he understood the common human problem of conditioned thinking or the need for continued eye-making. And he pondered, how can I come up with a way to pierce that conditioned thinking, that continued need for eye-making? And that's how he developed the Eightfold Path. Very specific set of a guiding framework to how to develop the Dhamma. And he never taught anything else. He didn't introduce other teachings. He taught for 45 years, and he never taught any other teaching except the teaching as it relates to the Four Noble Truths. I was writing an article on the Pali Canon, that's why I'm going to say this, because it came up in the writing and a question that someone had. There's a belief in modern Buddhism that there was 3 turnings of the wheel, meaning 3 initiations of truth, and these are different truths. And the Buddha never did that. The Buddha set the wheel of truth in motion 1 time in his very first teaching, and he would spend 45 years teaching to that same teaching. And just to answer what might be a question, the other two turnings are used to justify later developed teachings. That's all. And that's fine. That's how that developed. Every teaching the Buddha taught was in the context of the Four Noble Truths, and these simple directions on how to address the common human problem of fermentations is so useful, isn't it? We know what to do when I become enamored with my new shirt. I can remember because of this, well, I don't want to create an identity from this because it's just going to confuse me and cause suffering for me. When I think the next drug is going to make me stronger, I can remember, I don't want to do that. I don't want to engage in all the problems that might give, such as steroids or something else. When I start feeling emotions such as ill will or anger, I can remember the simple direction. What do I need to do with ill will and anger? Destroy it, let it go. I don't need to do anything else. I don't have to analyze where it came from. I don't have to figure who's the cause of this, or where did it come from, or what happened in my past to make me feel like this today. This is what's occurring right now. It's going to lead towards further confusion, delusion, and suffering unless I address it and let it go. Very practical advice, like all the Buddha's teachings. So any questions about this sutta? Tonight's art. So I'd like to hear how your practice is going, and if you have any questions or comments, start with Ram. Good to see you, my friend.
Practice is going well. It's steadying up and getting a bit over my confusion of earlier weeks. What to do and when and how.
Good.
So yeah.
How's Mara the Goose?
Still, actually, she wakes me up from time to time, while I'm pretending to meditate. So, she has her place now.
Yeah, that's not Mara. That's not a malevolent kind of creature. That's a good one. Yeah. So. Good for you. Padma, it's good to see you. How are you?
Good. Practice is really lots of great stuff.
Yeah. Isn't it?
Yes.
I'm glad you're here tonight. Yeah. David, it's good to see you. How are you?
Good. I'm still meditating twice a day. About 15 minutes each time.
Right, good for you.
Maintaining. No spurts of growth or anything.
Oh, you got to watch out for those spurts.
Yeah.
It's good to see you tonight. Gail, nice to see you tonight. How are you?
Good to be here. The practice is going well.
Yeah, good.
Nice to have that meditation that you can just take everywhere with you.
Yeah, isn't
it's only once a day, but pretty much every day, so yeah. I don't miss a day here and there. But I did have one comment on the reading tonight, which, I don't know, sometimes the readings, it seems like it makes it sound less than skillful to, like, enjoy a piece of chocolate or to a piece of art in your room. Like, it seems like you just have to be the very bare minimum. And I get it, like, not having attachment to it, but it kind of made it seem like, it was so sparse. I don't know.
Yeah, it certainly seemed like that. Remember, the Buddha taught the Eightfold Path as a middle way to avoid extreme views, but also to recognize an extreme view. So an extreme view could be a form of asceticism where there's going to be nothing in my house. It's got to be pure. The problem is creating identity over things. So you could have a house full of stuff as long as you're not identified by it. In other words, it's not important.
It didn't sound like that in the meeting.
Yeah, because he's speaking directly to that point, that even the practicality of things of a robe. So when the Buddha's robes got really ratty and were no longer useful, he got a new robe. But he didn't get a new robe to show that he was a Buddha. It was simply an expedient. Of course, they lived in places where they weren't likely to have things or consider things that were to hang on the wall or anything else like that. But that's not to say that other people didn't. So,
but that makes it sound like, if you really like a piece of art and you hang it on your wall and you're not attached to it, and if it wasn't there, you'd be okay. But, wow, I like that. It makes me feel good to have it there.
That's it's really everything comes back to right intention, and right intention follows right view. So right view is initially the view that I don't quite understand the Four Noble Truths and I'm going to develop that. And then the next step of right intention is to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. So that could, you could easily be attached to wanting to get a certain painting, and once you get it to attach yourself to that, or you could simply put it on your wall because it looks good.
Right, without the attachment.
Without the attachment. Mm-hmm. So again, the best example of that is of an awakened human being and how they lived in a world is the Buddha himself. I'm certain that he enjoyed sunsets and pleasant Dhamma conversations.
And maybe a piece of chocolate now and then.
Without creating an identity. And that, it really all comes back to that. If you get a chance, look at the Kula Sakaka Sutta, because it really talks to that in a direct way. It's just from a couple weeks ago. In everything that we find ourselves creating an attachment to, there's a tell. If we start reacting to something, whether it's anger or ill will or resentment or extreme excitement, recognize that you have created attachment, and to simply tell yourself, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am, and then enjoy the painting hanging on your wall or that nice piece of chocolate, because that's what's occurring in this moment. But you don't have to take the painting with you wherever you go. In other words, you're clinging to it in your mind. Mm-hmm. It's there, it's on the wall, I appreciate it. Here's a piece of chocolate, it's delicious, you know, or anything else, an apple, you know. It really doesn't matter. The whole point is creating identities over these things that are that we need to use. That one section, I think it was number 5, maybe 4, of be mindful of how you're using things. The Buddha didn't say don't use anything, don't touch anything, don't get involved at all in your life. He's saying simply don't create an identity over it. And that's it.
It almost seemed to me like that makes really good sense, and thank you. But it almost seemed to me like it was like, you know, use it out of necessity, but not out of enjoyment. But I guess I was just reading it wrong.
Well, and so even that part where the Buddha's talking about eating, he didn't say don't eat. He said look at your intention or your motivation behind your eating. If your eating is to grow large, mm-hmm. or for beautification, or for, that's unskillful. And it's not that it's unskillful and a sin, like we use
right.
sin.
Right.
It's just that it's going to lead to your long-term confusion, delusion, and suffering. But again, he didn't say don't eat. He said just don't create identities over it.
But I think what you're getting at, because I heard similar things, so that about guarding the sense gates, so... The way that the sutta was reading was if you're grasping after, so not so much, okay, I have a painting on a wall because that makes me an art aficionado or something, but it said regarding food, clothing, I don't know, the art, because I would hear that as like, because sometimes I have that question. Am I seeking distraction and sensual pleasure? Because I can sit there and go, oh, look at it, you know. And I'm in a lulled sense, like, I don't know. So it seems to me sometimes I'll have the question, is that grasping after sensual desires? You know, I don't see it as, I need a lust desire, but a sensual desire. I want to have quote unquote pretty things, you know, around. And then the food, it said, you know, eat for sustainment. And clothing, that it, you know, I thought your example was great about when I was a hippie, when I was a this, because I can see those things arise in me, like, oh, you know, because we still kind of like, oh, I don't wear those things, you know, I'm not going to wear shorts. But there's an attachment around an identity, but there is still the other piece of, I would like to wear that, I see something that I think looks pretty and I want to get it. It's not a functional thing, it's, I want that pretty shirt. You know, I have a pretty shirt on today. So,
is that unskillful?
I mean, that's what it, you know, it sounds like, just to be mindful as those things are arising.
To not have too much attachment, like I have to have, even if it's so much money I can't afford it.
Yeah, what is your intention behind what anything you're doing? In fact, ultimately, it's what is your intention to have this thought, any thought? You know, what's behind it? What's the motivating factor here? And again, it's not a moral thing. It's not like, you know, you need to acquire something because it makes you feel good. If that's the case, okay, first you recognize it, and then recognize that you're creating a condition over whatever this might be. A piece of art is a good example of that. So again, you can buy something and put on your wall simply because it's pleasant. Going back to food, the Buddha never said, especially in the sutta, it would come up, only eat very, very bland, tasteless food.
Right.
He just said, don't create an identity over it. Don't try to create and use your food to do something else. Use it for sustenance.
And it's never said, don't enjoy.
You got to remember, too,
that... What is said is be aware that enjoyment very easily leads to desire.
Mm-hmm.
That's
right.
Where...
Yeah, guard your sense gates because of
right.
that.
Right.
Your senses.
Right. So just being aware of it helps you to...
Yes. And now, the other thing that is important and to remember that this sutta, the Buddha doesn't get into the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, and Nichia, Anatta, and Dukkha, because he can't. He can't teach that the entire Dhamma in every teaching. But the group that he's teaching to understand that, they also understand that he taught the Eightfold Path as the middle way. And that's an important understanding because during the Buddha's, the time that he left the kingdom and the 6 years that intervene, He studied and practiced some very, very severe ascetic practices. And so as a child and a young adult, he had the exposure to every sensual delight that he could want in his father's kingdom. And he also lived that other extreme of complete denial of everything that makes us human. And upon his awakening, he said, it's not any of those things. It's not those extreme views. It's not denying myself a painting on the wall or a piece of chocolate. It's finding the balance of the middle way. And the eightfold, that's not out of frustration that I just saw it. It was just trying to, the incredible brilliance of the Eightfold Path is that it doesn't take away our humanness. It allows us to be fully human as we develop complete full human maturity or awakening. It allows us to have a piece of chocolate. It allows us to hang something on a wall or buy a nice shirt while learning to not create identity over these things. We're in the world. We're supposed to be in the world. We're supposed to be enjoying our lives without creating an identity over it. And one of the things that the Buddha realized is that we can deeply enjoy our lives without having to own things, without having to create ownership and identities over things. So if the painting appears on the wall, nice. Somebody gives us a chocolate or some soup, that's great. Just don't create an identity over it. And Gail, it's such an important question. I wish you'd come more often. Because it really is the heart of the matter, and it's one of the things that are most confusing about the Dhamma. The people that don't understand what the Buddha taught, including some modern Buddhists, claim that the Buddhist teaching is very pessimistic and nihilistic. All we're talking about is suffering. Much like a doctor first tells you what you've developed, say you're a smoker for many years and you find out, you go to a doctor and you got cancer, the first thing a doctor does is give you the diagnosis. You got this. The next thing he says is point out your contribution. You smoke too much. Stop smoking. The Buddha did the same thing. He recognized a common human problem of the ongoing distraction and preoccupation with dukkha. And then he said, by the way, it's your own craving and clinging that originates and perpetuates that suffering and confusion in your mind. Let go of the identity. And then you can enjoy anything you want without creating an identity about it. So it's just a great question. Thank you. I hope I answered it well.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
John, I just had a really good little kind of example on over the years, like going on retreats. There was one retreat I was on, and they told us all to go get our breakfast and then just sit, you know, wait until we start eating. So everybody gets there. You know, we're Westerners, we prepare our breakfast in a very particular way.
And they say, okay, now hand your breakfast to the person. That's where you realize attachment is present. I was like, oh my God, I got porridge, which I hate. And I was like, oh, now I've got to eat this porridge. And
So the porridge might even be more sustaining, but it wasn't you.
Yeah,
I've got a perfect example.
You're identified with your, you know, like,
that's just great. Yeah.
And this is the way I like it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's more questions in my head. Like, why do you enjoy your cereal the way you like it?
Yeah.
But you just can't be attached to it now.
Or why can't you enjoy your chocolate without nuts? You know, I mean, really, put conditions on everything. So, great question. Great explanation, too.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Keith, how you doing? Good to see you tonight, my friend.
Good to see you. My practice is going well. I took some time off this weekend from it and really noticed a difference. Just quickly, a difference in my thinking and my reactions. And I came back to it and came back very easily, and I feel much better.
Yeah, good.
So, thank you very much.
Thanks for sharing that. Glad you're here. Liz, how are you?
I'm doing well. How am I doing? I think having fine artwork on the wall leads to enlightenment. But my practice is going well. I have had a busy bunch of weeks and wasn't able to meditate twice a day. And like Keith, it really is something I've come to really enjoy, and I miss I see it in my reactions and things.
Good. Thank you, Liz. Laura, how are you? Good to see you.
I'm good. I'm glad. I enjoyed the reading very much, too. Good stuff to ponder, and those are great questions and examples.
Yeah.
Really, really cool. Because I was thinking with the painting thing, too. Okay, I can like something on the wall, but if you put up something brown, you know, I'm going to say, like, no. Yeah, so anyway. I'm certainly still got a ways to go, I know that. I'm going to join the camp of, it's been a rough week for me, just with a lot of transitions and changes and decisions and, you know, this kind of, yeah, so I'm moving. Doing some new training, my regular job is that, and then trying to get some administrative stuff, which is not easy for, but it's something, it's a struggle for me. So I have, my meditations have been wildly crazy, with a very busy mind, and so just sitting with that, and I was away this weekend, so all of it comes to the I can absolutely see just how, like, off my internal experience I have been the past days, weeks, the week, whatever it is, I don't know, but yeah, so I'm really grateful to be back here.
Yeah. Glad you're here. Matt will be back next week. He had a back to school night with his kids, so that's why he wasn't here. So. Yeah. Talk about clinging to kids. I mean, I don't know.
He attached to us.
One day he'll get it. So. Drew, it's good to see you. How are you tonight?
Good to see you. I'm well. I've initiated some meditation in my day.
I'd
like to thank you and the folks here for helping with that. This week is the first anniversary of my father's passing. Mm-hmm. And so it's been a
Yeah.
But the reading reminded me, it's also brought up a lot of childhood stuff, family-related issues, and the reading reminded me of the metaphor of being a cesspool that's used by a psychologist from the 70s, Aaron Byrne, games people play, and I'm okay, you're okay.
Yeah.
And he says all his patients come to him up to their nose in a cesspool, and then they ask him to stop the other people from making waves.
That's great.
And the thing I like about that is it really puts the onus back on me to take care of myself. And what meditation has done for me and being here reminded me, I don't know really of another way to extricate myself from that before.
Yeah.
I'm working on practice.
Good. Great. Thank you so much for sharing that. I mean, that really is the, Duke is the cesspool, and it's up to us to get out of it and stop complaining about other people pouring more stuff on us. Thanks for bringing that up. Great. Frank, good to see you. How are you tonight?
Good to be here. Thank you. Meditation's going well. We're getting busy, so I find it, I'm trying to be mindful of my ego at work around, you know, a lot of employees who don't seem to have any kind of program in life. Say what they want, no filters. But getting to the reading, I don't do well in heat, so I was a little bit kind of like getting tired, so I'm going to have to read it over again. And I thought when you were reading about the fermentations, I thought, great, just when I'm starting to understand mental fabrication, so the sutras get a little confusing to me because I like to keep it simple. And I like the middle way, and I like to think of in terms of it's easy to remember, you know, don't get attached to stuff, and learn to appreciate everything in life and not one particular thing, so that it makes it easy. I got, you know, busy schedule, so I can't be getting into the whole, you know,
That's great. Thanks, Frank. So, they really, you only have to remember three fetters rather than all the fermentations and fabrications. Create aversion and deluded thinking. That's the problem. You know? And if you address that, which the Eightfold Path addresses, you're good to go. Glad you're here tonight. Lorna, how are you?
Good, thank you. I think at the moment, throughout the day, I'm holding the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path in my mind quite well. Refer to it in my thinking quite a few times a day, and I'm mindful of it. A bit like more in my meditation's a bit wild at the moment. You would think that we're both compatible, but I think we're doing better through my day hours, and my meditations are a bit wild and get lots of thoughts coming in. I thought this tonight's talk was particularly interesting. Seems to cover a lot of stuff, that Buddha.
Oh, rascal.
You know, teaching this, but I mean, anyway. So I shall not be sitting in any brambles and cesspools and
wild animals.
Well, no, I won't be doing that either. That's good to know. So I'm on course and day by day, meeting it every day as it comes.
Thank you for being here. Anna? It's an inside joke.
I'm feeling incredibly human today, and I just keep stumbling on the same freaking rock in the road. So it's sort of like, you know, listen, everybody, I think about the Eightfold Path a lot. And it's sort of like when I take my eye off it for a minute, I have to kind of mess with why I keep having to learn the same freaking lesson. So there must be something, you know, when you say even in the parallel to the meditation, you know, in that last 5 minutes, you know, recognize the thought. What is the thought wanting you to recognize? And then go back to your breath. And so I'm like, I have to, you know, anyway, so blah, blah, blah. So, yeah. So it's just growing pains and struggle. But, I mean, it's all part of being able to recognize and use the Eightfold Path to change my view, to my intention, my speech. So that I can, you know, do no harm.
Great. Thank you for saying that. It often arises, especially as we're really making some significant changes in the way that we see things, see ourselves in relation to the world, that there's unsettled periods arise, and we're kind of conditioned to not want to feel that way. But usually those unsettled periods or times when it feels like nothing's really working, it's just blah, I think, from my own experience and talking to many, many people, that's when we're really integrating what we've learned so far and kind of making it our own and really deepening that view. And it's when we come out of that that we really are able to see that. And you hit it perfectly. You keep the Eightfold Path as a framework no matter what's occurring. And you'll get out of the other one. That's the path. You know, it's the path out of that. Those times of feeling like we're in the wilderness and all alone. So, thank you. Any other questions or comments from about tonight?
Can I say?
Yes, please.
I think of all, I say keep in mind the Buddha's teachings throughout the day. And it sounds so obvious. I think the one of the golden rules that I don't keep in mind is how brief a thought is. And just, it's holding in mind that a thought is just that, it's just a thought. And the next moment there'll be another one coming along. And although I try to keep the teachings in it, but if you could just hold that in mind throughout your day, that would help you a lot.
Yeah.
Just a thought.
Yeah. Just don't. Another one will come along
very quickly, and that one will go. And you know, just if I could do that,
I think that would
be an improvement.
Yeah. So you're talking about the Vitakkasimsana Sutta, the relaxation of thoughts.
That's just what I was
thinking. Yeah. and so that's the fifth that Buddha says. How do we deal with these difficult mind states? And last thing he says is, nothing else, everything else fails, relax your thoughts, meaning let go of the thought. Because when it's by holding on that we create persistent and reoccurring thoughts. Let go of the thought, gone. A well-concentrated mind will recognize that another thought takes its place, and another, and another, and another, without becoming attached to it. You know, it's anatta, the self-referential ego self that attaches itself to each thought that occurs because it needs to create an identity over each thought. And that's what creates this monkey mind and this ongoing tension.
Yeah.
Relax the thought. Thank you. This was a particularly remarkable discussion in class. The reason why I'm saying that is Saturday was also, and I just put the recording up. It was really a remarkable class on the self-governing principle of awakening. So if you get a chance, it's on the website under recent Dhamma talks. A few other announcements. Tomorrow is the first live worldwide streaming class. Begins at noon. There's info. Well, it is worldwide. Info is on dhammastream.com. There's also a link on Crossover Meditation. But it will be about a 45-minute class online. And it will be, right now, be every Wednesday at noon. And as this develops, there'll be other times that accommodate people in different parts of the globe.
Well, when's it going to accommodate dogs?
It always accommodates dogs. Dogs are always there. They're always present.
What is required to get into it?
Lots of money. you need right. There will be an app for mobile devices, but right now it has to be a laptop or a computer, and that with a broadband connection. That's all you need. If you want to be on screen and talk directly to me, you'll need a webcam and a microphone. But if you want to just type in questions or comments, you can do that too. It's a remarkable platform. It can accommodate any number of people. You have to. Well, you have to register, but you can. Yeah, you can just observe what's going on as long as you're registered and you're in front of your computer. And so the class will be about a 10-minute Dhamma talk. I'm going to start with what else? The Four Noble Truths tomorrow. A little time for Q&A and a 20-minute meditation, and we'll conclude with metta like we always do. I'm really looking forward to it. It kind of grew out of a few things because of the students that I have kind of spread all over the world. Many of them complain that there's no well-focused sangha, or they just can't find any practitioners. And so that was kind of the idea. So that's what we'll be doing tomorrow. Hope some of you can join us. Frank?
I had a question about the app that you were using. Was it the same one that you were streaming?
Yes.
I used that one on my phone. I was able to have that really? On my phone. I was walking around my kitchen with that thing.
Wow, because they said it won't work on a mobile device, but apparently it will.
It worked on mine.
So I take that back. If you want to, you can watch it on anything.
What kind of phone?
Actually, what they told me is that if you could use a mobile device to watch a recording of it, but you couldn't see it live, but you did. So
well, yeah, it went off at what, 2 o'clock?
I don't remember. Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. Well, yeah. Unless you went to the actual recording, which wasn't up till Monday,
No, I watched the one that Saturday.
Yeah, I was on a. I gave a presentation on another show that used the same platform, Vimalasari.
Okay.
So yeah, you can view it. Then I guess the only thing you can't do on a mobile device is be seen or talk to me. But if you can access the website, you should be able to type in any question you want too. So that's good to know.
That's the only thing I couldn't do. I was trying to tell you, but there wasn't a send button.
Oh, okay.
I was hitting the button to send the question, and you weren't getting it.
What was the question?
I forget.
He wasn't attached.
Just a call. Well, it was that quick.
Can I send a question?
Is there a link to it on the website?
On Cross River, there's a link, and also if you just go to dhammastream.com.
Okay.
When I registered.
And you used a mobile device to register?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, mostly because I've been on the worldwide Insight where that they use the same platform, and you know how great my computer is. I barely use my computer. I use the iPad or the iPhone, and without any difference.
Well, good.
I don't know about the questions, because the other two of the things I listen to, one of them I can ask questions. I'm not worldwide Insight. So
well, that's good to know. So, yeah. So you can use anything you want as long as you can connect to the internet. If you want to interact, you have to have a laptop or a desktop. So, what were the other?
Donna Dinner.
Donna Dinner is the November 22nd, Tuesday of Thanksgiving week, as it always is. This will be our 7th. So I hope you can all attend. For the first time, Julie from Love and Oven, the owner of Love and Oven, asked if we would help and set up and clean up. She's never asked before, and we always have. But so if you can volunteer your time to clean up or set up, that'd be great. Also to bring a gift. And we're going to take a donation this year. The Donna Project for the holiday is going to be collect money to give to Julie directly. She's never asked for a penny. She's been very gracious, and it's got to be pretty costly for her. We have given her some money, but we haven't taken a direct donation. So I'll have a box out here. We can put a few bucks in for Julie. On the website, on the top menu, is the link for more information. And if you can volunteer or you want to have some questions about the gifts, there's an email form at the bottom that will go directly to Maura, who's coordinating the volunteer effort this year. So, The other announcement is I'm going to, just like we did last year, we went through the Truth of Happiness course in 10 weeks over the holidays. We're going to do that again this year. And probably the second or third Tuesday and Saturday we'll start, and we'll end up somewhere towards the end of February, depending on the weather. So that's coming up. I think that's it for the announcements. Anything else?
The Dhamma dinner is on Tuesday the 22nd.
Tuesday the 22nd begins at 6. We'll end, about 8:30 or 9 o'clock. So, the whole deal about the Dhamma dinner is open to everyone. Please bring a dish to share if you can and a practical gift. There's a list on the website. And bring your friends and family and especially people that you know that can use some community, people that might be shut in or kind of down on their luck or for any other reason. It's been just a remarkable 6 dinners so far. There's always been some kind of story about the benefit just to the community and the people that show up. So please spread the word. Maura, you had...
Once I find a focus, we're going to have the gifts be a little bit more specific, because often there's, this excess gifts, and I've got, I'm going to try to tighten that up. One year we did a year ago in November when we did with Anderson House, that worked really well.
Yeah.
Again, I'm going to try to ask again, no used clothing, please. It's not working. It ends up being then my responsibility to bring somewhere else. And so just if we can, the weeks go on, I'll be a little bit more specific, a little bit more focused, and we'll have a cleaner plan about how things go.
Well, and when you decide, let me know. I'll just put it on the website.
Yes.
Okay.
And if anybody has a suggestion of a community group that we could engage that needs, please, email me, call me, whatever. Because my phone number isn't on the website anymore.
Nope, but the form is there. It's not, you just fill it out,
send
it to Mark.
Send me an email with your...
All right, let's finish with the Metta Sutta. We'll finish with the Karaniya Metta Sutta, the Buddha's words on Metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And the Karaniya Metta Sutta shows that the most loving and compassionate action that anyone can take is to engage wholeheartedly with the direct teachings of the Buddha and awaken. The Buddha's words on Metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.